You are listening to Arts on the Air, a bi-weekly-ish interview show dedicated to Savannah, Georgia's artists, musicians, and authors. Each episode will feature a guest in conversation about their philosophy, practice, and current projects, as well as their thoughts on the state of the arts in our community of Savannah. Our theme music is a clip of Summer Nights by the Eric Jones Trio. It's provided by our friend Mark Chesnow, who plays with the Eric Jones Trio every Thursday and Sunday at Good Times Jazz Bar downtown. Hey everyone, welcome to Arts on the Air. This is Tamara Garvey, and I have the pleasure of sitting down with Fibers artist Phoebe Plank. Welcome, Phoebe.
So happy to be here.
And Phoebe, she's getting toward the very end of her MFA at SCAD in Fibers. We're getting toward the end of winter quarter, and then she has one more quarter to go. So,
right.
And we're recording this, it's just the day after the Fibers Open Studio event, which was very cool, and probably a lot of people went too.
Yes, full disclosure, I'm a little bit tired
today. Yeah, it was a big event. It was well attended as always. Yes. But it's like a cool moment to, I think, be catching you to talk about your work, because you're a year and a half into your MFA, and you're getting toward the end, and so you're having to start think about launching off. Mm-hmm. So I'll read a little bit of your statement about your work. As an artist, I'm interested in collecting things and making them come alive. With what might be considered waste or overlooked forged materials, I assemble and create useful art objects and experiences. To address an overwhelming degree of alienation in our time, I aim to make work that is useful, even if in quiet sensory ways. It's beautiful. And of course, I'll post some photos of your latest work from the Fibers Open Studio, like when I post about the show and people can see. It was, it was like hanging pieces of branch and twigs and pods, and then there would be thread involved and things might be adhered to pieces of paper, and it's very delicate, and it's like living decaying objects.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. I guess.
I'm calling that work, or like my thesis, stick work, because and the prompt for what she's describing was like this group project I did last night, kind of asking professors and people that work in the building, as well as students and whoever came to Open Studios, to make a self-portrait using sticks and scraps. Sticks and I had scraps nicely laid out, and
you had foraged for piles of things.
Yeah.
Did you get a lot of self-portraits made?
It seemed like there was a ton. I mean, most people, I think, that are not at SCAD just took theirs home with them.
Yeah.
But I had strings hanging in the hallway, and so I had already put up a bunch kind of higher up that needed a ladder, and then allowed people to add theirs, or I helped them add them. And now the strings are relatively full. There's still a little space if you want to get up there. But
yeah, I think one of my favorite parts of it was that they were hanging from the ceiling. So they become, they can twist around. They become like mobiles. If a wind goes through, they're very delicate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think my work in my studio, I actually have it hanging on the wall, kind of the stick work that I've done over the last year. And I see putting it on the wall and making it balance on the wall. I've started only allowing myself one pin. And that's kind of existing in the world, and how do we balance and kind of exist through all these little physics experiments, almost in connecting things.
It's a physical challenge of how to get it up on the wall with just one pin.
Yeah, and how is it going to hang?
Yeah.
And then the beautiful thing about hanging it, suspending it, is you're just there. You just get to be, and you get moved by the wind more, and people can come amongst you. So they're beautiful ways.
I like your name of the project, that it's stick work. How did you come up with that?
It was kind of the easiest way to describe it at first. And then I just started to like that centrality of the stick. I mean, it was central in the beginning of this body of kind of sculptural work.
Yeah.
It started from some sticks that I collected over the summer and was really whittling down to perfect smoothness. They were already very smooth from the river, so I was just basically inspired by the river. And I like calling it stick work because it feels a little bit magical and super playful, and really this is your child acting that activity.
Yeah, but it's whimsical sounding.
Yeah, it's all my work seems to be pretty whimsical. But then I think it also starts to allude a little bit to magic, and in a way that is not to describe it as feminine, but, with all of that. I don't know. I wanted to kind of conjure up the power of doing these types of acts.
Well, I think a lot of, I mean, as a little kid, a stick, you use that in play acting as like a wand, like a magic fairy thing, which I think yes. probably is more of a girl child thing to do. I always used to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, who doesn't like a wand, like Harry Potter or whatever, but...
Yeah, I guess maybe wands have become more masculine.
I think
masculine because of Harry Potter.
I want like everyone to be carrying wands around, and then it starts to feel like scary. Like you see someone walking with a big stick, and you're like, "What's?" But like it's a walking, you know, like sticks are very versatile as like useful, like magical. Could be aggressive if really need be, or just to keep someone at like a stick's length.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, yours are small, delicate. Twig type things. It's not like a big walking stick.
That is true.
Yeah.
I guess though that act of like, it reminds me like that act of whittling the stick down, and like you're taking out a knife, but it's such a like a non-aggressive act. Like it's such like an internal like kind of meditative good act.
Yeah.
At the same time, I remember using it like walking around in the city, like in Oakland. Like I would go see my great aunt. And she'd be like, "What? You know, you need to stay over. You're not going home at this hour." I was like, no, it's fine. Like, Aunt Janie, like, I'm going home. I'll like whittle a stick on the way home so that I like, realistically, that's not a good idea because like you never have a weapon that you could be turned against you. Anyways.
Is this while you're walking or while you're on public transport, you'd be whittling?
Just walking. Okay. Just like walking in the dark.
Whittling while you walk.
You whittle while you walk.
Seems tricky.
Just to like, yeah, it's not functional, but it kind of like... It makes you look a little, like, crazy, I think.
Oh, okay.
And in that way, you're a little safe because people don't really know what to do with you.
Yeah, I can see that.
But it also is a little crazy.
It gave you a feeling of it's a little bit of an off-balance thing to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's very interesting.
Anyways, I didn't need to go all the way back there, but...
No, I mean...
Think about the sticks.
Is there somebody else in your family who does whittling? Is that... How did you, like, get upon that?
That's a good question.
As an action?
I think my brother does it a lot. Yeah. He, like, always is losing his pocket knife and requesting a new pocket knife for him to whittle, which he's not, like, a artisan. He's a special needs, like, 27-year-old, and so he's kind of, he's very childish.
Do you do it for sort of therapeutic, like, to help him with his...
Maybe.
Like, his dexterity, kind of?
He just does it because he likes having the knife, and he likes playing with things, and he likes breaking things.
So now both of you are always having pocket knives.
Yes.
Okay.
That's our... We both have pocket knives. Yes. Knives.
Now I want to talk a little bit. It looked like... So you're from Massachusetts, and then you lived in California for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
Was that where you went to undergrad?
No, it was before that I did undergrad. Okay. I did undergrad in Vermont.
Oh.
Middlebury
must have been
College.
Beautiful. Middlebury?
Mm-hmm.
I looked at Middlebury.
Oh, really?
There. Yeah. What did you study while you were there?
I went in thinking I would, like, study science. And, like, science is great, but the labs were extra long, and so I didn't want to stick with that because it just felt, like, unfair. And so I also... They have a really good language program, so I mostly got into languages there.
Oh.
I did French, and I started out with economics because I thought that would be functional.
Yeah.
And got those kind of requirements done, but mostly was interested in
languages. And then you did a lot of languages.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And then how long did you stay in Vermont after college?
No time at all. I was just there for the 4 years.
Yeah.
And then I moved. I tried New York for a hot second. I got depressed after like a month and went back to Boston. And that's where I'm from. And I got a job at like Wayfair, which is, you know, a big e-commerce company doing paid search, and that was hard for me.
You got like a desk job.
Yeah, I was like an online marketer, and that was soul crushing, and you know, nice team, but eventually I left that.
Yeah, you just hadn't found.
And that's
really
when I went to California because it was just so depressing being in Boston. Yeah.
Were you doing art when you were in college at all, or? Like, were you always kind of chipping away at art? Okay.
Like, freshman year, I tried an art class, and I was just really intimidated by people and their, like, figurative drawing abilities.
Yeah, the traditional things.
Yeah, there was no, like, fiber art class I was exposed to.
Yeah, so it was a lot to just jump in on.
Yeah.
Things like that.
I mean, it was fine, but it just felt really hard and not, like, something I was good at, so I didn't pursue it.
Okay, so then you went to California. Did that feel more at home?
That felt more... artistic, just like in how I lived and maybe who my friends were, and just the lifestyle. Like, I feel like I got into camping there. Like, I mean, I'd always spent time hiking and in the woods, up in the Adirondacks, but not like camping with friends and really enjoying that.
I guess, and the weather in California, more of the, like, the whole year that you could do things.
It was like any time you can go do those things.
And you were in the San Francisco area?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was living in the Mission, like, friends were running a gallery, so it's kind of becoming exposed to those things, but I wasn't at all in them.
Is the Mission just a really artsy neighborhood there?
It's, yeah, it's just like a, like, kind of a, like, in this gentrification transition space. So it feels like, you know, a little more like Starland to...
Yeah, to the downtown.
To the old town, yeah.
Okay, so you had some friends who were in the gallery field.
Like, just a couple.
Yeah.
And, like, friends, you know, with a small group and then a larger group, we, like, you know, did the trek to Burning Man, and so I was exposed to art in that way.
Oh, wow.
Which is just a great art gallery.
Yeah, just using nature in art, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And just, like, full-on either immersive spaces or... you know, objects with killer backdrops.
Yeah. Were those, is that, that's what really impressed upon you a lot, was the kind of installations, like a big spatial type of thing?
I think it was definitely like mind boggling. I don't know if, I still didn't think it was something I was going to do, but I was like, wow, like,
yeah.
I think living as art, that kind of became really real there. Like, everyone's just like living their weird art way here for these 2 weeks or whatever they do.
Yeah, is that how long it goes on?
Maybe it's only one
week. Wild, yeah.
Unless you're setting up camp and doing extra stuff. But actually, if we're searching for like the kernel of inspiration, again, I don't think I really realized it then, but the first time I was like exposed to like an artist's life was while I was in school. I studied abroad in France.
Okay.
For, you know, just a semester, but I was placed in the home of like a kind of house mother who was cooking for me, as well as like I was living there kind of paying her rent. And she was just an amazing person, an artist, and living with her was like, oh, this is like so mystical and amazing, and like our relationship was so important to me. She's since passed away, but I'm actually like kind of dedicating my thesis work to her.
That's amazing.
And like her style of just being and caring for objects. And
How old was she about when you were there, when you lived
with
her?
She was probably in her 60s.
Okay. So she was like a grandma kind of figure.
Yeah. She feels like my French grandma, but also like, I don't think she didn't have kids. So she kind of was the type that was like forever young or like,
yeah,
she kind of related to people just as adults.
Maybe she was a little bit whimsical and a sense of magic too.
I think so.
Where in France was that?
In Paris.
Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. Were you did you get to be pretty fluent in French?
Yeah. They forced you. Like, Middlebury's hardcore. Mm. We had to sign a contract. So I'd only taken it for, like, 2 years, but then there we had to take all our classes in it.
Wow.
At home. Yeah.
So when you were in Paris, you had to just be taking French classes with native students?
Yeah. It was pretty...
Wow.
It was a lot of tears. And, like, they love to really put people on the spot and do, like, live presentations of subjects. And so, like, on the first day of class, they would hand out a sheet and you had to pick out what was your like expose gonna be on, and I just like looked at it. I didn't understand a single word on the page.
Yeah.
And just wanted to die.
Yeah, I can imagine. I think maybe I had 2 years of French in college, so I'm trying to think of how good I would have been at the end of that, and no, I would not have been able to take a college class in French.
It was a push. Yeah.
That's incredible.
But she helped and get through it. I mean, my GPA went down, but it was fine.
Yeah. Oh, did you? So while you were in Paris, were you going out to museums and things while you're there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I definitely was. I mean, I think I was interested in like her world, or she was taking me to like a kind of silent film in Korean. Like, it just was things I just had not been exposed to. Like, I grew up so vanilla. Like, you know, my parents met at business school and they've had a very nice life and they're very like generous and loving. But they're not interested in the arts particularly.
Yeah, and this was just so cosmopolitan.
Yeah, and yeah, totally. Like, she was French-Algerian and, I don't know, would have friends over and have dinner parties, just like tiny little get-togethers, and people put on little performances, and I just was like, what is this world?
That's incredible.
So different than, like, my WASPy life.
Yeah. I hope this woman continued to host American students just many times after that. It sounds like a lot of lives she probably changed.
There's like some Society Stefan that like we formed on Facebook one time.
Just people who lived with her.
Like bring her over to the U.S. to visit, but it never materialized.
Did you stay in touch with her all these years, like after you left?
I did. I wasn't good at like writing or whatever, but every time I went to Paris, maybe saw her a year or two after, and then a bunch of years after, I let a lot of time pass, and I like was so bad, I hadn't called or anything in advance, and she actually, maybe I tried and she wasn't getting back to me, and so I go to the house and I knock on the door, and there was also like a painting restoration studio underneath.
Oh,
that was her,
that's fun too.
Kind of estranged husband's business. And so somebody opens the door because people are always working there. And they're like, oh, you're looking for... So, no, she's not. Like, haven't you heard? She's in the hospital. And I was like, oh, no. I mean, it was amazing I was there.
Yeah,
that
she caught that.
I got to go see her and, like, talk with her. But... And she was doing well, but they were just finding cancer everywhere. So...
Oh, so you saw her at the end, basically.
I saw her at the end.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's amazing timing.
We were like, oh, I'll come back next summer. You'll be on chemo. We'll go back. Like, we were dreaming, but...
Oh.
Yeah, but I got to see her at the end, and I got to see, like, how, like, they had to tell people to stop coming to the hospital because there were so many people trying to come, and she was getting overwhelmed.
Wow.
I was just so glad to see how, like, not alone she was.
Yeah,
she
it's
was
a really
so full.
Cool legacy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, well, thanks for talking about all that. That's really interesting. I feel like all this is a really good intro. It all just feeds into you know, like... picking up your life and moving across the country and going to grad school for fibers. Like, all this just kind of feeds into it, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
All right. So tell us, so let's go back to,
yeah,
so you're living in California. So
so
at some point you started getting into art somewhat, and then to such an extent that you decided to apply for grad school across the country. How did that happen?
I think I got a little jealous, or not jealous, but just like, well... Yeah, Burning Man for me was like a break with reality for, you know, multiple reasons. And then it was kind of hard to go back to, like, I think I had a headhunting job at the time, like as a researcher. And I was just like, my mind was just unleashed.
Yeah.
You
like
know?
That was not going to satisfy
like, I couldn't,
you.
I was just like running around in my head.
Yeah.
And so I went through a long period of like just trying to get a hold on my like, on my mental stability or like ability to like exist in the world and like what will work for that. You know, it's definitely deemed as like mental illness within a like a hospitalized sense, but it's like, I don't know, I think it's worth feeling as many things as you can feel, and especially as you like can move past them, it's very empowering.
Yeah.
So yeah, that whole process has brought me down to the ground and to art, I think.
Okay.
Because, like, you get into the hospital, they're like, do you like to use crayons or whatever? And I'm like, I love all that stuff. Yeah, bring it on.
Just that art therapy is such a big part
and
of therapy.
Then somehow the hospital became, like, my first studio. And so, like, I don't know if I should talk about all this, but...
You had to go into a program, or you put yourself in a program?
My family put me into one.
Okay.
My sister was diagnosed bipolar, like, years before, and so they're like, we know the drill.
Oh, and that
we gotta take you to the hospital.
Really runs in families, right?
You're like, yeah. And it, especially when like you kind of have this conception of how to deal with a problem, you kind of go and deal with it the same way.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly like, yeah, my aunt as well definitely suffered from it because it wasn't really diagnosed or dealt with, I think, in a good way.
That's great, so that your family was like serious about...
They're serious about
it.
Like, they might have been too
at.
Serious about it. Like, there's other ways to deal with it, in my opinion, now, having gone through the system. But yeah, it was, you know, it's one way. It's like a slightly traumatic way, of course, to be like locked in a cell, essentially.
Yeah.
And then you're like with other people and it's scary. But the first time I'm like, whoa, like, I'm just going to do what I want. I'm going to do art. Second time, I was like, okay, if I'm back in here, I'm at least going to get some work done. I'm bringing my portfolio.
Wow.
They, like, carried me off with my portfolio. And I was like, okay, this is a mess. But
that's kind of like a movie.
You know, it really...
Yeah.
Yeah.
You were like, I'm going to bring my serious
it's
art
like
supplies in here.
It's like moments of being,
here.
Like, very down in that recovery. And
right.
then just, like, movie.
Okay.
And then, yeah.
So you were really, like, got down to it and started heavily working on your art in there. As a way to, like, work out for yourself what you wanted to be doing with it, what direction to go in, and how it might how you might be able to incorporate it into your life in a bigger way kind of thing?
I think so. Like, it started as like just this flighty activity, like kind of erupting in mania, to like, okay, well, now that I'm doing this, yeah, like, what if I did go to school for this and like learn about it?
Yeah.
Okay, maybe I should actually build a portfolio. Maybe I'll take a few classes to kind of like have a few projects, and then
yeah, see what appeals to you.
I don't know if like in my mind, SCAD Fiverr's acceptance rate is probably 100%, because I feel like they're just like so open-minded, and like if somebody wants to come, they're like, great.
Yeah. If someone is like a manic pixie dream girl, then they're like, come on in.
Like, perfect. So I applied with like a pretty random portfolio, in my opinion, of like, I've knit this scarf and here's some drawings. And and they're like, great. And I was like, oh my gosh.
It is Fiverr's, yeah.
I'm in.
How had you heard of Savannah and SCAD in general?
Over COVID, my parent, or like right before it, I guess, they moved down to Sea Island.
And so, your parents did?
Yeah. So I've been spending time with them down there, and all their friends are like, oh, you should go to SCAD. You should go to SCAD. You're so creative. And I'm like, oh.
Okay.
Okay. It seems doesn't seem overly intimidating for the art, you know. We still had that kind of like harbored fear of, is the art world too intimidating?
Oh, right. The traditional academic kind of classes.
Yeah, and just like being able to, you know, produce something like that mural on the wall.
Yeah, like a realism painting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so,
I should say, so we'll give a little shout out. We're in the King Oliver's space, and our sometimes co-interviewer David Lachlan painted an amazing jazz mural on the wall in here. So when you come in to eat, you'll see the mural that Phoebe's talking about.
Yes, it's very beautiful.
Okay, so Savannah was like the only place that you were, this is where you thought of coming.
I'm kind of like one thing at a time
person. Yeah.
And I was like, this seems reasonable. They let you apply like, you know, a couple weeks before the start date. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when you arrived here, where did you live when you first got to town?
I've only lived in one spot. Somehow, like, I came for one day to look for apartments and had maybe two or three lined up, and then managed to get another one lined up at the same time while I was sitting at, like, Mate Factor and was right next to it. And so I ran over, and now, yeah, I've been in that apartment between Kroger and the park.
Oh, amazing.
For, like, 2.5 years.
That's so great. So you're so close to the Fiverr's building.
Mm-hmm.
That's very cool.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess you're foraging around in Forsyth Park and the squares a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I run around Forsyth or like lie in the grass. I mean, sometimes I will collect in the city, especially like odd scraps. But if I want to like actually forage or collect things like nice long grasses and things, then I'll go out to like different wooded spots.
Yeah. Yeah. How did you, so when you start off in the MFA program, I know there's like so many different aspects of Fiverr's. I was just looking at the different types of projects that you posted on your Instagram, and there was weaving and felting, and there's pattern design, and there's printing on fabric. How does it, do they, starting off, does everybody like have to dabble in everything to figure out what you want to do? Or do most people come into the program already knowing they, you know, they have a direction they like to do?
Yeah, it does depend. So they'll take people that have very little kind of formal experience like me, or people that have a lot of formal experience. And then the only difference is I had to start with like this 502 class, which is an overview to all different types of things.
Okay.
So that class is where I like learned how to do felt and learned how to like make digital patterns and learned how to do kind of all those things. So that was like the first introduction, like how do you spin? How do you embroider? How do you make like those rug tufting stuff?
Oh yeah. Were there any parts of it that you especially liked or did not like?
Definitely the felting I liked.
Okay.
It's a little, I don't know, the space that you have to do it in Pepe like smells like you're like in a town pool. So I haven't done enough of it because of that.
But it's like a damp feeling?
Like it just, yeah, it just feels like you're in, it's like, it's the wet lab. It just,
it's a, is that what it's
that's
called?
That's what it's called.
Okay, the wet lab.
Yeah.
And felting is like, I'm a little bit, it's like you have yarn and you're like picking at it, like pick, pick, pick. And it's almost like,
that is a way.
It's almost like ratting your hair, right? Where you're just like making it a big
item. That's true.
Is there a name for that? What am I thinking of?
You're thinking of a different type of felting than I'm thinking of, but they're both felting. Basically, you have wool and you are doing something to make it get together more.
Yeah. like a tight fat fibers.
Yeah. And so you can needle felt with like either one to like 50 needles, or, you know, there's whole beds of them for like industrial style where you have this needle, kind of barbed needles, getting the fibers locked into each other.
Yeah.
I actually am not super barbed needle felting, but there's also wet felting, which is using like soap and water and like just movement, whether it's like rubbing your hands or rolling kind of under your arms, or like, you know, you think of nomadic societies, they're like whacking, they're laying it all out on the grass, whacking it with sticks, rolling it up, and then pulling it behind a horse.
Behind a horse. So it's what you're describing with your hands. It's like traditional like clothes washing type of.
Yeah, it has almost that kind of feel.
Yeah, like you're reenacting a washing machine kind
of. Yeah, like it gets hot, it gets cold, it gets soapy, whatever.
And pulling it behind a horse, that's incredible.
Yeah, I would love to do that someday.
I can imagine Scads just like setting up a
demo be a good collab,
in
yeah.
Forsyth Park of people being able to watch.
Between the equestrian center and...
There you go, they're all set.
Yeah, that would be a wild spectacle.
So what is that wet... the wet soapy action, what does that create? What is the name? That's just called felting, or?
It's called, felting or wet felting.
Okay.
More specifically. And basically the water is just allowing you to like heat it up and allow things to flow. So when you heat it up, then the fibers are going to open. And then when it cools down with cold water, they're going to close. And so the more you kind of move them at one, and then you like kind of lock it in place with the other temperature kind of going back and forth.
And so doing this, you can create either like a big wall hanging, or you can make kind of a 3D sculptural sort of piece.
Yeah.
It's basically to create like a fine art object.
You think of any felt hat, it's going to be made in that way, more or less. You know, they're usually starting with like a blank that's already pretty formed, but you could start just from raw roving, which is just like wool, and learn on YouTube how to make a hat and like all day.
Wow. Everybody listening, you too could make a hat
with YouTube.
Okay.
I've never done it. Looks hard.
Yeah.
It's extremely hard. Or you could start with a blank and like steam it, so like that kind of, it could be as functional as that.
Yeah,
you could put like some plastic or something in it if you wanted to make a pocket. Or you could do it on some type of form, like on a hat, you know, it's on like a head form.
Yeah.
To make it more sculptural. But I've just done, I don't know about wall hangings, but like space hangings. And what I like about it, it's just an extremely absorbent material. Like it takes a very long time to dry off after all this.
Yeah.
But it also is absorbent of sound. And like being in like a little studio, you know, apartment that's the living room of a... like an old Victorian, basically. Like I have the fridge pretty close to my bed, and so I initially conceived my big felt piece as like a blocker of the refrigerator sounds.
Wow.
Which it doesn't do that well, but.
So, okay, so that was the felting. And then with weaving, I know there's different types of looms. I know my friend Katie has talked about a jacquard loom.
There's a lot of types of looms.
Okay.
The jacquard is the most advanced.
Yeah, because it has like a computer program running with it.
Yeah, the one that we have does. The original jacquard didn't, it was like a punch. I mean, it was still kind of a computer of that time. Like it's the basis of all the computing that we do.
Yeah, that's
Was
incredible.
Originally just technology from a loom. But the difference with the jacquard is that each heddle, like each string, has its own, can be controlled and manipulated individually.
It makes me think of like piano, like when you open up a piano and the keys all connected to a different.
It's actually exactly key. Like those pianos that have like the rolling.
Oh, like the rolling
like
paper
a music
with
box.
The bumps.
Yeah,
kind of.
And like the holes and those go through.
Yeah, the keys strike the bumps
to,
and that makes the noise.
Use your feet and pretend like you're making this amazing song.
Okay, so that's kind of the principle of the jacquard loom.
If you can kind of set it up and program it either like with a computer or with these like, you know, old punch cards, then you have the pattern registered in.
Yeah.
And you can just kind of go back and forth and have a crazy pattern happening.
It's a little like Braille.
Yes. And so that's the most advanced. You know, it used to be before the jacquard, there was always somebody up there, and that person was called the Dobby, which you probably heard again from Harry Potter, not to reference it twice. But
Is that character's name? It comes from.
Yeah, I think so. Because you'd have someone that ideally be pretty small, because who knows how tall like the building is? That's like reading things and manipulating, like they are the machine.
Wow, like a conductor.
Yeah, and so that's actually what you call like a step down loom, Dobby loom, and those are like hooked up to a computer, but it's not like each one. You know, some of the, you know, every other string is connected, or every four strings are connected to the same, you know, manipulator, like the same puppet.
Oh, okay. Pull,
so that you can make a certain, like a certain complexity of pattern. It'll have to like either repeat, or depending on how you set up the strings in those patterns, you can do crazy things.
Okay, so there's like a limit to how intricate it could be with a Dobby loom, just because of the physics of it.
Yeah, without changing.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then down from that is just a floor loom, which is like, so those are both like fully, they have like these assist and programs in them. And then a floor loom is just, you have a certain number of shafts, and then you have the pedals that go with them. So rather than just like one pedal to go up and one pedal to go down or change, you'd have from 4 to 16 maybe pedals to to dance with.
Huh.
I'm not a weaving expert.
Yeah, are there any of these that you really like, or did you just kind of do the required?
I really wanted to try it, because like if there's a loom around, I would love to be able to use it. Like if I ever in life come across a loom that, you know, needs just using.
As one does. Yeah.
It's possible.
Like when you go in a room and there's a piano, then some people know how to play that.
Exactly. Yeah. You know? And they get disused because nobody knows how to use them. Anyway, I wouldn't be able to, but I could now figure out how to use.
You can do a little bit.
So I took like the Dobby weaving class, which was awesome, with Deborah first. And then I kept weaving after that when I was in Lacoste, but it was kind of a crummy loom that they have over there. So I haven't woven again since, but maybe next quarter I'll put one on.
Yeah. Talk about, so I saw that you had studied abroad in Lacoste, so that's cool. You had previously studied abroad in Paris, and now you got to go to the countryside of France. How was that experience?
Yeah, it felt like a homecoming. Not like in a crazy way, but just right before studying abroad, you know, back in 2010, I had worked as an au pair to try to get my ear better for the French, and we were actually right around there. Right around Lacoste. So it was nice to go back to that area and have it feel familiar.
The landscape you were familiar with.
Mm-hmm. And being like a French speaker, I felt it was like exciting, like, you know, maybe one of two grad students that were there that quarter. There were still like a few older people, of course, that I connected with, but it was nice to get into the community a little bit, and actually ended up meeting somebody, so I was like spending a lot of time in the community.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's a really different experience than studying abroad there and just having to just be amongst kind of the SCAD buildings and using like pidgin French to, you know, buy things when you go into town.
No, because it's unfortunate. They kind of talk about how it feels like things have changed, where people are a little less engaged. Like it's less of a big deal to go to France than it was like 10 years ago. And so people are a little less like engaged in where they are. You know, you're walking down the street and just kind of like on your phone and going, you know, between the dining hall and your space, and, you know, maybe you're exploring a little bit, but there just feels like it's more of a disconnect between the town and the students in some ways.
Yeah, not like the most incredible experience of your life. Like you're finally in France, you might not ever be there again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of taken a little too lightly and too easy maybe.
Did you, when you went there, is it with the goal of studying like a particular project that is related to being there, or how does that work?
I like that it was in the countryside. Like it's hard. I mean, the park is very nice, but it's hard not like being near even just like some real woods that I can just walk to or run to. So I was looking forward to that for sure. And just, the opportunity to kind of network over there, because I'm like trying to move there after graduating. So I was like, this feels important for my career. I need to see if I can go to Lacoste. It was a bit of a push because I was the only grad student going. I wasn't going to like, I had to change my studio to be like this kind of undergrad class, which ended up being good. I did some nice work, I guess.
Did you work with, since you do a lot of foraging, I know at different times of the year, it's either like lavender or sunflowers are the big thing there. Did you kind of work that type of thing?
It was spring, so those things weren't in full bloom yet, but there was tons of like little stuff popping up, and I love like the weeds.
Yeah.
You know, they're not actually weeds really, but what are they called? Dandelions. They were like so tall.
Yeah.
And I was really interested in their stems, like after, you know, the blow balls had all kind of been blown away, or so I picked tons and tons of those and I wove those, and they were really cool because some of them were bright green and some of them were kind of purple.
Oh, that's nice.
I struggled a little bit to get them in there nice, and then since they have been somewhat eaten by bugs, but it's still kind of a beautiful like falling apart kind of composition.
They're pretty strong, that weaving. Right, those weeds?
They are.
Like a lot of them together, I guess.
Yeah. Right? When no, dense. It's really good twine. I think if it was like not treated, but like if I had maybe dried it out more fully or done it in a different way, they'd be more kind of fast. Or
is that why the bugs are eating them? Is because they were still kind of
maybe it's living? Also because I left like the heads on. And maybe those are good breeding grounds.
It's a lot to think about.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
So I wove with those, some other random flowers, just like really things with nice stems, some grasses, like long grasses.
It's these beautiful fields there. It's these like,
Just like along the grasslands. Path. There's just gorgeous.
Yeah. Is the point of being there at the end, are you supposed to do an exhibition at ShopScat or have things for sale there?
Maybe if you're like an atelier student, okay. Like a kind of alumni coming back and doing a residency. But as a student, there was one kind of showcase amongst the school. We didn't really get a chance to do a big showcase, and I actually missed it because I got sick at the end.
Oh.
So there was no showcase, really, for me, sadly. But it was a nice experience.
Yeah. I wanted to ask a bit about, the work that you were showing last night at the Open Studio, where you do a lot of like, you'll have like a little square of paper and there's like a tiny, tiny plant or something, and you kind of sew loops over it and like sew it to a little piece of paper.
Yes. Okay.
I've seen this on your Instagram. I had so many questions about how it feels like so much could go wrong material wise. Like, how do you do it where the paper doesn't end up with a crease in it? How do you do it where puncturing the paper doesn't create a huge hole, and how does the like tiny, tiny piece of plant not break in half? Like,
those
I'm so perplexed
questions.
By just like
sometimes all those things happen.
How
the, But for the paper, I tried going bigger, which is fine, but it's really hard to tension it, and so like by staying small, like a small piece of paper, those are probably like 4 or 5 by 5.
Okay.
And
I feel like when you're working on paper and you're like manipulating it, it just feels like it would crease so easily, like that it, and yours look perfect.
Well, you just have to hold it right there. You're only affecting it right there.
Okay. And put so your finger
your,
right next
your
to
fingers
where the hole
are really
is.
Close to the hole to like keep it there. It's really satisfying stitching in paper. I would recommend it.
This feels like very tiny, meticulous.
And it's like you kind of make, if you're coming up from the back, say,
right.
You're going to make the mark from the front to know where you're going. And then you're just putting the needle through.
Okay.
So I think I maybe sometimes you can have a piece of cardboard next to it so that you can poke through it.
Yeah. So is it hard to puncture and not, then the hole doesn't just like rip into a big hole?
No, they'll stay pretty good. Unless you put them right next to each other, you're not going to.
Okay.
Or if you tug too hard on the string.
Yeah.
And then you need to match up the string with the needle. Because the needle is deciding the hole size. And so depending on the size of your string, you don't want the needle to be like making this big space and then having this tiny string, which the string is always smaller. You're always going to see the hole. But yeah.
Yeah. And then the fact that the little tiny, tiny piece of plant that you're...
Yeah, the little pressed flower.
Flowers adhering to a square of paper, and yet the little flower doesn't rip in half anywhere.
Yeah, they do. I mean, if it's sticking out, they do rip in half. But if you're just careful with them and just keep them stacked somewhere, they just stay.
And you kind of pair on your Instagram, you're kind of pairing them with like a Rumi poem.
Is that
right?
Yeah. So
can you talk about that a little?
Those were because I have like a pocket Rumi that I basically use as like my tarot deck. It's like if I need a little something, I'll just open it up and try to get a little wisdom out of Rumi. And I guess since I keep it around with me, I'll end up pressing flowers in there, or like putting things in there. It's a way to save them. And so I think some, like, I forgot about that, and then I noticed it. I was like, oh, that's so nice. I'll use that.
Yeah.
And so then I kind of associated that poem with that piece and did a nice Instagram post.
Yeah,
about
just
that.
Whichever page you happened to have pressed it in, that was the poem for it.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
Yeah. I just feel like they always speak, it always seems right whenever I, like, pick out a random Rumi poem.
Is there any kind of line that you can remember that's, like, a key one you think about?
They've got a lot. There's one, like, long one about, like, chickpeas, where the chickpeas want to be, like, out. They're like, come on, let me go. And then they're like, no, keep cooking. Like, when you just kind of get knocked down and again and again and again in life, it's like you're just getting really tasty and nutritious.
So we are the chickpeas in
this
metaphor.
Chickpeas. We're trying to, like, get out, but we're not fully cooked. It takes a long time to really cook chickpeas well.
Do you think this is about becoming, like, a complete person and then to be ready for death? Is that what you think it is? That's what I was thinking.
I mean, what's nice that they're talking about the chickpeas is they're talking about becoming a, you know, nutritious thing to be fed to something else. So maybe, I never thought about that, but maybe we're trying to become a whole person, or, you know, an enlightened person to be better food for whatever it is we are
fed to in death.
That just
sounds like capitalism, maybe. We're just getting used until we're fed to...
Interesting. Yeah, it's all the same.
But to the corporate overlords.
But not to the corporate overlords. I mean to the just the universal energy.
Yeah, I think in a nice way it would be us becoming a complete person, and then we just become one with the earth again.
Yeah.
I think that's...
I mean, we definitely do, whether we are conscious of it or not, become one with the earth and the universe after the bodies perish.
So we've hopefully reached our fully nutritious and cooked state before that.
Well, it's unlikely, but yeah.
This is so funny. I thank you for having remembered this chickpea poem out of all of them.
There's, like, so many good ones.
I wanted to ask you a bit. You've had a project that you did that was related to Georgia longleaf pines.
Oh, yeah.
Can you, and I know you talk about how few there are of these trees still in the state after, like, the centuries and centuries of these pine trees getting chopped down to be used for, I guess, boats or houses, lumber.
Yeah, lumber,
like,
was a big turpentine before that. Like, they call it naval stores. I don't even know what that really means, but... And then, yeah, just stripped with lumber. Once we had, like, the railroads and stuff, I think they all just came down. It was... It's like, all over... the Atlantic world. Europe, like, apparently it's the base of the Brooklyn Bridge is longleaf pine.
Huh.
It was, like, more strong than steel.
It's incredible.
Like, so resinous and dense, which, shout out to Repurpose Savannah, you can find there. You certainly can't find it at Home Depot. There's, like, 1% left of the forest in Georgia.
Yeah.
Maybe not even.
What was it? So the project that you did, it was about the pine needles?
Yeah, I think, like, I wasn't using those pine needles. In my mind I was, but I wasn't. I was using Lalibali pine needles, which are long pine needles and lovely,
okay.
Which is kind of the tree that has come in after that.
Oh, that's like the new generation of tree?
I think that's, like, it grows a bit more quickly. That's just what's been...
Okay, that's what just
happens
to have
reseeding, like,
become.
Around here, yeah.
Okay.
That's most of those pine trees that you see around here. but so that was an effort to use them. I was trying to figure out, like, what else could I weave? Because I'd tried weaving with grass and I loved it. And I wanted to try, like, a new material. And, like, I don't know how much the trees like it, but they seem not to mind that much. Like, picking some pine needles just smells amazing.
Yeah.
Like, it's lemony almost. It's just so good. And so I eventually figured out, because I didn't like weaving them normally, like putting them in sideways and having them just flat on the fabric, but I started having them stick out. And at the time I was struggling with, like, my hair and my scalp and, like, yeah, kind of, because I've been on lithium for 8 some years, it's hard on your skin.
Oh.
And so in my mind, that's what's causing some of my, like, scalp issues, which are doing pretty good right now. Thanks perhaps to this meditation I was doing with these pine needles to kind of, like, create this hair, which is like the hair of Mother Earth. It's called like Meditations on Skin and Land.
Huh.
Kind of equating trees to hair to pine needles, and thinking about like some really beautiful moments I spent with my grandmother, who passed away recently, who was just like petting my hair, like, "Oh, so lovely."
And, yeah.
You know, she's kind of, we were like complimenting on her, on her ponytail. She could barely see, tiny little ponytail, like what was left. Oh, thank you. It's like, I don't know. It's just,
and
so
you had
funny.
That kind of same sensory feeling if you're like on this ponytail of
pine
needles.
She didn't even remember. I was like, "Nanny, you told us when we were growing up that if we brushed our hair backwards, we would get smarter." And so we were all brushing our hair backwards and like thinking of you. And she's like, "I never said that." And I was like, "Oh my gosh!" Well, I love that idea, and making the pine needles felt like the hair backwards.
Oh. That's funny. It's just like a joke she told one day, and you've had it. You've been thinking of this for decades, and she had no idea.
I mean, she totally told us, but yeah, maybe she was just playing around, being kind of fun.
Mm. Do you mean when you flip your head over and you brush the bottom of it?
Like
yeah.
Hard.
Yeah.
It was so hard. I worked hard at it every so often.
I do love all of your, just your foraging in general and your things with seed pods, and they're very, very delicate.
Mm.
And a lot of your art pieces, I wonder, like the sticks, I guess, as time goes on, they don't degrade at all. But, you know, when you're using flowers or little pods or tiny, tiny seeds, it's like, do things degrade over time? Is that sort of a part of your work that it's inherently only meant to be here for a time?
It's like, it's definitely a reality of the work. It's something I'm still, I don't know if I've fully like figured out. And like, I went through a moment of this quarter where I was like, I need to think about all the ways to process things. And I was like, should I burn the work? Should I like, should I put it in water? Should I like put it out, you know, hang it from some tree somewhere and let it just be in the wind?
Like, is it Richard Serra? Is that his name? Who does all the, I think where he changes things outdoors, but it's all just things that would naturally degrade. He's not like adding anything. It's just,
oh, I think it's Andy Goldsworthy.
Okay. But yeah. That's
maybe
what I'm thinking of.
Richard Serra is the big, like steel.
Oh,
he has huge,
he's like the huge sculptures. Okay,
like mind-boggling spaces of steel.
I knew there was somebody who does modifications in nature that isn't changing or disrupting anything. It's just sort of temporary changes.
Goldsworthy will go like it's he goes and like lies on a roof when it's raining, and like that area gets dry, and then he gets up and leaves, and like that's his piece,
right?
Or there's like Richard Long, or that's the British guy that just like walked in a line back and forth and
just to tramp down some
just
grass.
Made a little path, and that was his thing. it's not as minimal as, and some of their stuff lasts too, but it has different degrees, and it all degrades though. Even the sticks, like I'll put a little piece of fabric on it, it's all naturally dyed, so all the natural dye is always degrading too.
Oh, that's true. It's just kind of fading or changing.
Like you want to escape that to a degree, but at the same time, it's a really calming, and it just like shows time. And I'm not sure what to think about it all. There's a lot to think about for that.
Yeah, I guess there's something to be said for, it's like if something is going to last, it's because, you know, maybe it's these like paints or whatever that has chemicals in it, and then you put varnish on it, which is another chemical, and that'll hold it, and it'll last forever. So there's something to be said for like, if you're not using these, you know, machine-made other items, that things of the natural world are going to degrade over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it all degrades at some point, but it just feels like we have so much stuff already that I don't necessarily need to make stuff that will last.
Yeah.
I don't know, because I don't want it to just be a pile of junk at the end either. You know, I want to try to do them well. I'm probably learning how to do things better. But, like, the pine needle pieces, I've come to love how they've aged. At first, I was really disappointed, you know, that they didn't stay, like, green and scented and great.
They're a little brown now.
They're, like, but they have a almost pinkish orange patina.
Oh.
It's
almost, like, rusting.
Yes, it is.
Okay, well, we're kind of coming to the end. I really appreciate you talking about all this. I kind of wanted to end with just asking, so you have one more quarter at SCAD, and then what are you thinking about post-SCAD?
Just for a last thought on the last subject.
Yeah.
I feel like that watching things degrade, like I watch them either like on my table or where, you know, like I'm always watching things degrade, but if you have them up on the wall and you like care about them, I feel like they stay better, nicer, and I feel like that's the point of art and engaging in it. Anyways, the plans for after.
Is that something you, do you enjoy thinking about what's coming after the program, or are you just loving so much just being in the fibers department and playing around and you...
Yeah, it feels like a really special moment right now.
Yeah.
I'm really loving getting engaged in Savannah as SCAD and Savannah Beyond SCAD for sure.
Yeah.
That's been a big thing for this year. That's made it really interesting.
Well, maybe you can fail your classes and then you'll have to stay in the program.
I know, I thought
it's
like if I don't finish the thesis, like technically could stick around through the summer and the fall.
Yeah.
Then I'd still have access.
They'll be like, we don't understand. She was doing great for a year and a half and then she just started tanking.
Yeah. But the more time that I give myself, the more time I will take and the more I will suffer about it. So I think I should just get this thing done. But I don't know, sometimes I look forward to it, but change is hard.
Yeah. What do you, any other type of work that you're looking forward to doing?
I want to move to France as a base. It's just something I've been wanting to do for, you know, since 2010 probably. So
yeah.
It'd be nice to do it.
Well, you worked so hard to become fluent.
Like, I don't have any kids right now. Like, it's a good...
Yeah.
It's a good time. And then... I'm trying to just be an artist there and kind of network and probably figure out ways to be learning in the same way. Because this is like 2 years, but I don't have any undergrad in this. Like, there's still a ton to learn.
Yeah.
In terms of like how to be an artist. I don't want to like cut that short and be like, oh, we'll see if it's successful or not. Like, I need to give it a little time.
Yeah, so maybe you can still be taking some classes right there.
Yeah, whether, I'm sure there's so many things to discover. But again, like one thing at a time.
Thank you so much, Phoebe. This has been really fascinating talking to you about all this.
Super nice.
I'll post, obviously, your Instagram. We'll post a bunch of photos of you. and yeah, best of luck with your final quarter, or not, depending if you end up taking it.
Yeah, we'll see. I'd love to be able to kind of install myself over there and be able to invite people to come and have people feel like welcome and that there's a spot to... you know, that's connected to Savannah, kind of there. So that's my goal.
We'll keep an ear out. Okay, so you heard it, everybody. You heard it here. Phoebe's inviting everybody to her new chalet in France.
Yeah, it's
we'll see.
Kind of, well, we have a few bedrooms in the house. This kind of random town outside Avignon, but there's train access, so that's cool.
It sounds incredible. I've been working on French on Duolingo for ages, so
perfect.
I'll be great.
Okay, great.
I will be.
You're invited.
Très bien. All right.
Je suis fête.
Thank you, Phoebe Plank. Thank you so much for being here. And again, this was Tamara Garvey with Arts on the Air.
Thank you, Tamara.